This is Lecture 3 in the series Essentials of Capitalism. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I want to begin this morning with a discussion of the influence of the division of labor on the institution of private property. This influence is almost universally ignored. Typically, people think of private property in terms that would be appropriate only in a non-division of labor society. By that, I mean that people usually think of private property as being of benefit only to its owners. They believe that before the non-owners can benefit, they must first become owners. This belief underlies the popularity of all forms of redistributionism and socialism. People believe that so long as wealth remains concentrated in the hands of a relatively small number of capitalists, the capitalists alone benefit from it. For the great mass of non-capitalists or small capitalists to benefit, it is believed, the wealth of the capitalists must first be taken away and given to them, or be held by the government and used for the collective good of all. Closely related to these ideas, of course, is the almost axiomatic belief that capitalism is a system that operates only in the interests of the capitalists, and that the defenders of capitalism must therefore either be capitalists, or be in the pay of the capitalists, or simply be perverse enemies of the great majority of mankind. So deeply rooted are such convictions that it is often thought to be a sufficient refutation of the arguments of an advocate of capitalism to suggest the size of his bank balance or stock holdings. Similarly, in reporting election results, the news media routinely explain votes for relatively pro-capitalist policies on the basis of the voters' income and wealth status. Even the alleged friends of capitalism often share the conviction that private property and capitalism serve only the capitalists. Their notion of how to fight the spread of communism is to first create more capitalists. And where some faint glimmering of the idea may exist that perhaps leaving the wealth of the capitalists alone might actually make everyone better off, a horde of skeptics rushes in to denounce what it calls the trickle-down theory. Well, the first thing that should be realized this morning is that in a division of labor society, all private property that is in the form of means of production, that is, of capital, serves everyone, non-owners as well as owners. In a division of labor society, the means of production are not used in producing for their owners' personal consumption, but for the market. They are used in producing goods that are sold. The physical beneficiaries of this private property, and it is the far greater part of the capitalist wealth, are all those who buy the products it helps to produce. In other words, it is the general buying public who are the physical beneficiaries of the capitalist capital. Consider, for example, who are the physical beneficiaries of the auto plants of General Motors? That is, who physically receives the product of these plants? Is it the stock and bondholders of General Motors? No, of course not. The number of GM's cars that is produced for the capitalists who own GM is relatively trivial. Almost 100% of General Motors' auto output goes to people who do not own a single share of its stock or a single one of its bonds. The same is true of every other business enterprise. The simple fact is that in a division of labor society, one does not have to own the means of production to get their benefit. One only has to be able to buy their products. In a division of labor society, one gets the benefit of means of production owned by others every time one appears in the market as a customer. Indeed, it is in the very essence of a division of labor society that one obtains the benefit of others' means of production, just as one obtains the benefit of others' labor, and that this occurs by means of the purchase of products in the market. To say all this in somewhat different words, there is a general benefit from the capital owned by the capitalists, a benefit which everyone shares in his capacity as a buyer of products, even if he himself does not own any capital. Indeed, if we are to acknowledge the truth, we must go further and recognize that the general buying public not only benefits from the means of production owned by the capitalists, but exercises real and decisive power over the ways in which they are employed. Because by the pattern of its buying and abstention from buying, the public determines which products it is profitable to produce and which it is unprofitable to produce. It thus places the capitalists in a position in which to make profits and avoid losses, they must produce what the public wants to buy, and abstain from producing what it does not want to buy. In a division of labor capitalist society, it is thus ultimately the customers, the consumers, who determine the pattern of production, including the relative size of the various industries and even the specific methods of production used in every industry. This last comes about because the demand of the consumers determines the relative prices of factors of production, such as the wages of skilled labor versus unskilled labor, or the price of copper versus the price of aluminum, and thus which methods of production are more economical in any given case. Now there are, in fact, two aspects to the general benefit from the existence of the capitalist capital. The first of these is the one I have just explained, that of the buyers of products benefiting from the capital that helps to produce those products. The second is in connection with the fact that capital constantly appears in the market as a demand, expenditure, by the capitalists for means of production, including labor. The capitalists begin their productive activities with outlays of money for labor, materials, and equipment. The revenues they subsequently take in from the sale of the products they produce are then almost entirely re-expended in the form of fresh outlays for labor, materials, and equipment. These outlays of the capitalists for labor are what make possible the purchase of products by non-capitalists. They are the source of the wage earners' incomes. It should be obvious that the more economically capitalistic, capital-intensive, the system is, in the sense of the capitalists expending a larger proportion of their sales revenues for means of production and a smaller proportion on their own consumption, the higher will be the income and consumption of wage earners in comparison with the consumption of the capitalists. In other words, the more the capitalists abstain from consumption in order to accumulate or maintain their capitals, the larger is the share of the economic system's output of consumers' goods that goes to wage earners, and the smaller the share that goes to capitalists. There is a conclusion that follows from all this, which will appear highly paradoxical to many people, but which is nonetheless perfectly logical and correct. And that is that the more the private property rights of capitalists are respected, the greater are the benefits to non-capitalists. Because then the capitalists will be encouraged to save and accumulate capital. Their own consumption will be small in relation to their capital, and will grow only as their capital grows. In each year, the demand for labor will be correspondingly larger because of the capitalists' greater saving, and the share of consumers' goods purchased by wage earners will likewise be correspondingly larger. Also, of course, the more the property rights of the capitalists are respected, the more powerfully do the incentives of profit and loss operate to make the capitalists satisfy the demand of the consumers. Because, for example, the profits of doing so are correspondingly less diluted by taxation. By the same token, the losses of failing to do so are not offset by reduced tax payments on other profits, nor are they compensated for by subsidies. In addition, respecting the property rights of the capitalists means leaving them legally free to enter any area of production they wish. It thus means the freedom of competition, and it means not imposing on them arbitrary requirements that raise costs of production and prices, such as building codes, product safety regulations, and environmental controls. All of these regulations are actually at the expense of the consumers, because anything that raises costs of production ultimately raises prices. Now, what is even more important in the long run is that if the capitalist property rights are sufficiently respected, then from year to year, the total production of consumers' goods available to everyone tends to grow, and thus the purchasing power of everyone's income tends to rise. What I am saying now is that in a division of labor, capitalist society, not only is there a general public benefit from privately owned means of production, but that that benefit tends steadily to increase. It tends to increase precisely because of the saving and capital accumulation, the profit and loss incentives, and the freedom of competition that the institution of private property creates. Let us consider first the role that is played by the capitalist saving of their sales revenues. The larger the proportion of sales revenues saved and productively expended, that is, expended for means of production rather than consumers' goods, the higher is not only the demand for labor relative to the demand for consumers' goods, but also the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. In other words, the greater the degree of the capitalist saving and productive expenditure, the higher not only are wage payments and the consumption spending of wage earners relative to total consumption spending, but also the expenditures for capital goods relative to consumption spending. This has a vital bearing on economic progress. The ability to implement more advanced technologies, and thus to raise the productivity of labor and the general standard of living, depends on a growing supply of capital goods being put into the hands of the average worker. More advanced technologies almost always require the use of equipment and materials representing a larger quantity of capital goods than the less advanced technologies they replace. For example, an up-to-date factory of almost any kind represents far more wealth and capital than its less advanced counterpart of a decade or a generation ago. Now, in order for the supply of capital goods to grow from year to year, it is necessary that the current production of capital goods each year exceed the using up and wearing out of existing capital goods. Capital goods are used up and worn out in the production both of consumers' goods and of capital goods. In order for an economic system merely to stand pat, to remain stationary, it must devote to the production of capital goods a proportion of its overall ability to produce that is sufficient to replace the capital goods it consumes. If it is to progress, it must devote to the production of capital goods a larger proportion than this of its overall ability to produce. If it fails to devote to the production of capital goods even the proportion of its overall ability to produce that is required to offset capital consumption, then its supply of capital goods falls and its ability to produce falls. It retrogresses. What I mean when I talk of the proportion of an economy's overall ability to produce that it devotes to the production of capital goods is simply this. At any given time, the economic system has some definite overall ability to produce. Within broad limits, this ability can be devoted either to the production of capital goods, like diesel locomotives, trucks, and factory buildings, or it can be devoted to the production of consumers' goods, like passenger automobiles, refrigerators, and houses. In order for the economic system to progress, it is necessary that a sufficient proportion of its productive ability be devoted to the production of goods like diesel locomotives and so on, so that it begins each year in the possession of a larger supply of such goods than it began the year before. Now, what determines the proportion in which the economic system's existing ability to produce is devoted to the production of capital goods rather than the production of consumers' goods is the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. For example, what determines the extent to which General Motors devotes its existing resources to the production of diesel locomotives and trucks relative to passenger automobiles, and what determines the relative prosperity and growth or decline of companies exclusively producing the one or the other type of good, is the relative demands for these goods. And what determines these relative demands is the extent to which people save and expend their savings for business purposes, relative to the extent to which they consume their funds. To return to our starting point, the greater is the share of the capitalist sales revenues that they save and productively expend, and the smaller the share that they consume, the greater is the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods, and thus the greater is the production of capital goods relative to the production of consumers' goods. If the property rights of capitalists are sufficiently respected, they are motivated to save enough so that the relative demand for and production of capital goods is great enough to achieve capital accumulation and thus to make possible economic progress. Now, the profit and loss incentives, and the freedom of competition that the institution of private property creates act no less powerfully to steadily expand the supply of goods coming to the market and promoting the well-being of everyone in a division of labor society. Under the freedom of competition, the only way for a business to earn an exceptional rate of profit is by being a leader in the improvement of production. It must introduce new and improved products or more efficient, lower-cost methods of producing existing products, or it must be a leader in meeting changes in consumer demand, inaugurated for the most part by economic progress. If it does this, it expands its sales revenues and profits at the expense of the sales revenues and profits of other firms that are less quick to improve. For it has something better or equally good but less expensive to offer than they do, and so buyers shift their purchases to it. The same result, its gain in sales revenues and profits, accompanied by a decline in the sales revenues and profits of others who are less innovative, occurs even in the exceptional case in which a business cuts its costs of production and yet keeps its selling price absolutely unchanged. In this case, it does not attract sales revenues from other sellers in the same industry, but it almost certainly attracts sales revenues and profits from sellers in different industries. Because to the extent that it saves and reinvests its extra profit anywhere in the economic system, it will bring about an increase in production. Its new production in some other line of business will take sales revenues and profits away from whichever sellers buyers now abandon in order to be able to buy its new production. For example, imagine that a maker of razor blades, say, finds a way to cut his costs and yet chooses not to cut his selling price at all. He will not reduce the sales revenues and profits of other razor blade manufacturers, but to the extent that he saves and invests his extra profit in the production of some other product, whether it is an aftershave lotion, chocolate bars, or anything, he will increase the supply of that product and take sales revenues and profits from somewhere, because to buy this additional product of his, people will have to restrict their expenditures for other things. Now, the combination of an innovator's higher profits and others' lower profits, or outright losses, is what then impels others to improve their production too. These others may simply want to cash in on the high profits of the innovator and so duplicate or improve upon his innovation for that reason. Or they may be in the position of having to duplicate his innovation in order merely to stay in business. Please observe that under the freedom of competition, innovations must be adopted not only to make exceptional profits, but to be able to make any profits whatever. They must be adopted merely to be able to remain in business at all. This is true even of the innovations that at first do not have any impact on the sales revenues and profits of direct competitors, such as the case of the razor blade manufacturer I just mentioned. Because sooner or later, as the result of the freedom of competition, such cost cuts are translated into price cuts, and whoever does not produce with the lower cost method cannot cover his costs. Even in our present-day, highly inflationary environment, in which wages rise every year and prices hardly ever fall, it is necessary for all producers to adopt cost-cutting improvements. They must adopt them in order not to have to raise prices in full proportion to the increase in wages, and so be in the untenable position of requiring price increases greater than their competitors in order to stay in business. There is probably no business in the United States today that would still be in business had it not adopted major innovations over the last generation, and probably even over the last decade. It is not possible for a business to sell at the same prices as others and yet produce at substantially higher costs. Not when its selling prices are governed by their costs. Nor is it possible for a business to sell a substantially poorer product than others at the same price they are asking for a better product. The penalty for falling too far behind, either in efficiency or in quality of product, is going out of business. The only way to avoid this penalty is by adopting the innovations before it is too late. Now, the fact that sooner or later competitors do adopt innovations not only enables them to increase or restore their own profitability, or at least to survive, which of these it is depends on how much sooner or later they adopt them, but it also takes away the special profits of the innovators. The more general an innovation becomes, the more it becomes the normal standard of an industry, the less can any exceptional profit be made from it. For example, at one time Henry Ford was able to make an exceptional rate of profit because he produced automobiles on a moving assembly line and used interchangeable mass-produced parts. When those methods of production became standard and the price of automobiles came fully to reflect their use, no special profit could any longer be made from them. Today, of course, the requirements for mere existence in the auto industry far surpass anything in Ford's day. The fact that the special profits of innovating do tend to disappear because competitors catch up has the further effect of requiring that everyone who wants to go on making an exceptional rate of profit over an extended period of time must introduce repeated innovations. If he is to prevent the loss of all of his special profits to competitors who are catching up, he must make fresh advances over them. In this way, the combination of the profit motive and the freedom of competition leads successful producers to seek continuous improvements. That is the only way they can sustain an exceptional rate of profit. They cannot rest content merely with their past successes. In connection with the freedom of competition, it should be realized, moreover, that the ranks of the capitalists are open to everyone, including penniless newcomers. Those who have a valuable idea but lack the funds to implement it themselves can offer a partnership to others who do have capital, and further capital can be borrowed. In a division of labor capitalist society, there is an enormously large number of possible sources of financing for any new idea. It is equal to the number of individuals or combinations of individuals who possess the amount of capital required. For example, if $1 million is the sum required, there are as many potential sources of financing as there are individuals or combinations of individuals who possess $1 million or more. This situation guarantees that every new idea has many possible chances for being implemented. If the innovator does not possess the necessary capital himself, he can turn to as many separate sources of financing as there are individuals or groups who do possess the necessary capital. It is not necessary for him to convince everyone, a majority, or even a substantial minority of his fellow citizens that his idea is valuable before he can put it into practice. If he owns the necessary capital himself, he can go ahead without convincing any other person at all. If he does not own the necessary capital himself, then he needs to convince only a minority consisting of possibly just one other person, and in no case of more than a relatively very small number of people who in combination possess the necessary capital. Thus, the institution of private property in a division of labor capitalist society provides the incentive of profit to introduce continuous innovations, the incentive of avoiding losses to keep up with the innovations of competitors, and opens the possibility of introducing innovations to everyone in the entire society. It is impossible to imagine an economic institution and an economic system that could be more conducive to economic progress. I would like to point out the further very important fact that the incentive of profit and loss and the freedom of competition have a vital bearing on the ability of the economic system to accumulate capital. The more powerfully they operate, the more they increase the amount of production, including the amount of capital goods, that can be obtained with any given amount of existing means of production. Because of this, the lower is the proportion of the economic system's efforts that is required to offset its consumption of capital goods, and the more rapidly it can accumulate capital goods by devoting any given larger proportion of its efforts to their production. The following example will help to make this point clear. Assume that an economic system possesses 10 units of capital goods. For the sake of simplicity, assume that the whole 10 units are consumed in the current year's production. If the economic system operates with a certain degree of efficiency, it can produce, let us assume, any combination of capital goods and consumers' goods, ranging from 20 units of capital goods and 0 units of consumers' goods, to 0 units of capital goods and 20 units of consumers' goods. Under these conditions, If the economic system is to replace the capital goods it consumes in production, it would have to divide its efforts equally between producing capital goods and producing consumers' goods. It would have to devote half its effort to producing 10 units of capital goods, and could devote the other half to producing 10 units of consumers' goods. But now suppose that the incentives of profit and loss and the freedom of competition operate more powerfully, with the result that the existing 10 units of capital goods can be used to produce any combination of capital goods and consumers' goods, ranging from 40 units of capital goods and 0 units of consumers' goods, to 0 units of capital goods and 40 units of consumers' goods. Under these conditions, the proportion of its effort that it needs to devote to producing capital goods to replace the 10 units it consumes is not one-half, but only one-fourth. Because if 100% of its effort devoted to capital goods would produce 40 instead of 20 units, the proportion of its effort required to produce 10 units is only one-fourth, not one-half. It could replace all its capital goods consumed in production while devoting three-fourths of its efforts to the production of 30 units of consumers' goods. If, however, the economic system went on dividing its efforts in a 50-50 ratio between capital goods and consumers' goods, the half that it devoted to capital goods would produce 20 units of capital goods instead of the mere 10 required for replacement. In other words, with the same proportion of its efforts devoted to the production of capital goods as before, the economic system would now be progressing thanks to the higher productivity of existing means of production, whereas before it was stationary. Now, there are several specific ways that the more powerful operation of the profit and loss incentive and the freedom of competition raise the productivity of existing means of production, and so contribute to capital accumulation and economic progress. A more rapid rate of introduction of new and improved products, especially in the form of new and improved capital goods, is perhaps the most obvious way. Certainly, if the production of trucks, for example, can be substituted for the production of horses and wagons, and then the production of better trucks for that of poorer ones, the productivity of the economic system's existing means of production is increased. It is also increased by the day-by-day efforts of businessmen to control and reduce costs of production. Cost reductions are largely synonymous with reductions in the quantity of labor required to produce any given quantity of output. Such reductions, of course, leave that much more labor available to produce an additional quantity of other output, either of the same kind or different kinds. A cost cut saves labor in all cases in which it is achieved by the use of labor-saving machinery. It also saves labor in all cases in which it represents using less of a material to accomplish the same results as more of a material. A saving of material is a saving of the labor required to produce the material. A cost cut also usually represents a saving of labor insofar as it is achieved by using a less expensive material to accomplish the same results as a more expensive material. The less expensive material usually is less expensive in large part because it requires less labor in its own production. And of course, simply seeing to it that workers do the work they are paid for both saves labor and holds down costs. For the rest, cost cuts represent the substitution of labor or materials having less important alternative uses for labor or materials having more important alternative uses. For example, the substitution of the labor of a draftsman for that of an architect in the copying of plans, or of aluminum for copper, say, in the transmission of electricity. In such cases, a gain in production is achieved because a more important product is gained at the expense of the loss of a less important product elsewhere. Finally, and very importantly, the productivity of the economic system's existing means of production depends on the maintenance of proper balance and coordination among all the different branches of production in the face of continuous changes in economic conditions. Production would be severely curtailed if, for example, the steel industry were overexpanded at the expense of coal mining, and then the steel mills become largely inoperative because of a lack of coal. It would collapse if such things became commonplace as the supply of lumber having no connection with the supply of nails, or tractors being produced without adequate spare parts, or with the wrong kind of spare parts, or with the fuel required to power the tractors being in the wrong place, or of the wrong kind. Such things are minimized or altogether prevented in a capitalist economy because of the operation of the profit motive and the freedom of competition. Under capitalism, industries that are relatively overexpanded and products that are relatively overproduced suffer unprofitable selling prices. This limits and actually reverses the excesses by encouraging the withdrawal of capital or causing the outright loss of capital that has been invested in them. By the same token, industries that are relatively underexpanded and products that are relatively underproduced enjoy premium rates of profit. This both encourages the investment of additional capital in them and itself provides the means of investing that capital, the latter because the high profits can themselves be saved and reinvested. Moreover, the great majority of such mistakes are not even made in the first place, because the effect of the freedom of competition is to place the capital of the economic system precisely in the hands of those who in the past have demonstrated their ability to avoid losses and to make profits. This ability includes the ability to avoid the mistake of relative overinvestment and overproduction while making good others' relative underinvestment and underproduction. The use of forethought to avoid losses and to make profits also means that as far as possible, such mistakes are avoided in the first place. The fact that profit and loss incentives and the freedom of competition play a vital role in capital accumulation sheds light on the economic failure of Soviet Russia and socialism. For over 60 years, apologists for Russia have claimed that her miserably low production of consumers' goods is the result of the large proportion of her resources devoted to the production of capital goods. Now, it would be possible, perhaps, to explain the lack of consumers' goods for a few years on the grounds that the means for producing them have been devoted to the production of capital goods instead. If, however, capital goods have in fact been accumulated, the effect is to make possible an increase in the production both of capital goods and consumers' goods, because the possession of more capital raises the overall ability of an economic system to produce. If, with a greater overall ability to produce, an economic system still does not produce more consumers' goods, the explanation cannot be that it is continuing to devote some given high proportion of its efforts to the production of capital goods. If the production of capital goods is to be the explanation at all, it must be that the economic system devotes a larger and larger proportion of its growing ability to produce to the production of capital goods. In the case of Soviet Russia today, which has had little or no increase in the average standard of living since 1913, indeed, it would be suffering from famines in the absence of an outside capitalist world to turn to. This would imply that by now, something on the order of 99.44% of output must be in the form of capital goods, and be increasing further every year. That by now, Soviet Russia must be purer in its devotion to the production of capital goods than ivory is in soap. That it must be one enormous factory from Leningrad to Vladivostok. Yet curiously, with all this implied devotion to the production of capital goods, the Soviet Union cannot generate sufficient capital of its own to build a major automobile or truck factory or natural gas pipeline. Again and again, it must turn to the United States, to Japan, and to Western Europe, even to Italy, which was the source of its most important truck factory. The truth is, a socialist country can never accumulate much capital, even under the most favorable circumstances of outside aid, because its inefficiencies are so great. The greatest efforts it devotes to the production of capital goods are always in danger of being more than offset by the low productivity of those efforts, to the point that it cannot even replace the capital goods it consumes in production, and thus must decumulate capital. A socialist country lacks the incentives of profit and loss and the freedom of competition, and consequently a price system. Production in Soviet Russia and the other socialist countries is characterized by the kind of chaos I described a few minutes ago, of gross discoordination. Soviet Russia is the country par excellence in which wheat rots in the fields because the tractors have broken down for a lack of spare parts. in which lumber is useless for a lack of nails, in which giant power plants cannot operate for a lack of generators, in which steel mills close for a lack of coal, and coal mines cannot be exploited for a lack of the right kinds of steel. It is also grossly and notoriously wasteful in its use of labor and all other factors of production, and it introduces virtually no improvements in production of its own. Virtually every innovation introduced in the Soviet Union has either been stolen or at least copied from the West. In the absence of an outside capitalist world from which to obtain supplies, usually provided free or on credit that will never be repaid, such a country must inevitably collapse into the self-sufficiency of small agricultural districts, that is, revert to feudalism. For local self-sufficiency is the only recourse people have when the supply of vital goods produced by others is subject to constant interruption, as it is under the economic chaos of socialism. In such circumstances, people must attempt to produce everything they require under their own direct control, and that is feudalism. So long as capitalist countries sustain Soviet Russia and the socialist bloc, whatever accumulation of capital it manages to achieve takes the form of an expanded ability to produce the means of power and prestige for its rulers, above all weapons, the support of international terrorists and subversives, and in today's world, space extravaganzas. No effort is made by the socialist leadership to improve the standard of living of the average person, except temporarily, in response to the threat of revolution, or in ways that serve to increase the regime's power and prestige, such as providing people with radios and occasional television sets, in order the better to control them through propaganda. Otherwise, apart from this, the rise in the standard of living of the masses is consigned to the generation of their grandchildren. And when the grandchildren arrive, it is consigned to the generation of the grandchildren's grandchildren. This lack of concern with the welfare of the average person is no accident. It follows from the very nature of socialism. Philosophically, socialism regards the individual as an object of sacrifice to the ends of society or the state. Economically, the absence of profit and loss incentives and of the freedom of competition deprives the individual of all power over production. The rulers of socialism have no financial self-interest in serving customers. They are not personally enriched if customers are better satisfied, nor rendered poorer if customers are worse satisfied. And of course, when the customers are worse satisfied, the customers have no alternative that they are allowed to turn to. In fact, the masses of socialism do not have the status of customers and should not be thought of as customers. They are serfs who must take what they get and like it. Thus, however paradoxical it may seem, socialism, a system allegedly based on the maxim of brotherly love, is utterly indifferent to the well-being of the great majority of people. The dictator of Soviet Russia, or any other socialist ruler, does not lie awake at night thinking how he might provide the average citizen of his country with a better pair of shoes or a better breakfast. If there is no threat of an impending riot over such things, he could not care less about them. But there are people who literally do lie awake nights thinking of such things. They are none other than businessmen and capitalists. A businessman or capitalist who has invested in a shoe store or shoe factory, in a restaurant, or in the manufacture of breakfast foods, or who is contemplating such an investment, is vitally interested in improving the shoes or the food he sells. He is interested not because he values the satisfaction of others' needs for its own sake, but because he values his own wealth. And the only way to increase his own wealth, or prevent the improvements of others from decreasing it, is for him to serve his customers better and more efficiently. Thus, capitalism, the system of self-interest, works to the interests of all. It is the system of the harmony of self-interests. It is a system in which each serves the self-interests of others, who in the meanwhile serve his self-interests. It is a system in which the individual serves the self-interest of all those others who pay him. We have seen the general benefit, the increasing general benefit, that everyone, capitalist and non-capitalist, large capitalist and small capitalist, derives from the institution of private property in a division of labor society. We have seen that in a division of labor society, everyone benefits from private property in the form of means of production, of capital who buys its products, or who is employed by means of it, and that the employment of capital is in fact ultimately controlled by the buyers of products. We have seen how the institution of private property promotes saving and capital accumulation, how the more the property rights of capitalists are respected, the higher our wages and the consumption of wage earners relative to the consumption of capitalists, and how the supplies of capital goods and the purchasing power of everyone's income are made to increase and go on increasing through the combined operation of the incentive to make profits and avoid losses and the freedom of competition. And we have seen how all of these benefits are destroyed by socialism. I now want to consider the special benefits derived by the capitalists from their ownership of capital. Obviously, no matter what gains their capital provides for non-capitalists, it is better to be a capitalist than a non-capitalist, and better still to be a wealthier capitalist than a poorer capitalist. What precisely is the nature of these special gains that the capitalists derive from their capital that is over and above the gains that everyone else derives? There is undoubtedly a temptation to answer, the capitalists earn profit or interest on their capital, which the rest of society does not, and that is their special benefit. This answer is mistaken. It is true that only the capitalists earn the profit and interest on their capitals, but to the extent that they save and invest their profits and interest, the profits and interest provide the same kind of general benefit as their original capital. That is, they represent additional means of production serving the general buying public and additional wage payments. As I see it, there are two gains that the capitalists receive which others do not. The first is the portion of their profits and interest that they do not save and invest, but consume. Even this overstates their special gains to the extent that their consumption includes such things as support of universities, libraries, and opera companies. Because here again are general benefits. The second is the psychological value that the possession of capital has. To the extent that one possesses capital, one has the potential of consuming it. One thus has the psychological security of knowing that one could consume it if one had to or wanted to. Now, in the case of even moderately large capitalists, in today's context, say those with a capital greater than a few hundred thousand dollars, so long as the institution of private property remains secure, this advantage of owning capital usually remains strictly psychological. That is, the potential they have of consuming their capital usually remains just that, a potential. The capital itself is generally not consumed, but left invested, and upon death it is passed to heirs. The major exception to this rule is when the rate of profit or interest that such a capitalist earns falls to the point that it cannot provide the standard of living he feels he can afford on the basis of his accumulated wealth. In such circumstances, he encroaches upon his capital. On the basis of this and previous discussion, it should be clear that if the institution of private property is secure, the actual consumption of capitalists, whether out of current profits or interest, or out of capital accumulated out of past profits or interest, is relatively insignificant in comparison with wages and the consumption of wage earners. In fact, I estimate such consumption as normally being on the order of only about 10% of the so-called national income, which is the sum of all profits, interest, and wages. This estimate is consistent with the capitalists consuming an amount equal to between 2 and 3% of their capitals each year, and with their total capitals ranging from 3 to 5 times national income in size. Such rates of consumption would in turn be consistent with the average rate of profit and interest, ranging from 4 to 6%, and half of the profits and interest being consumed and half being saved and reinvested, or from 8 to 12%, and a quarter of the profits and interest being consumed and 3/4 being saved and reinvested. It should be realized, of course, that a ratio of accumulated capital to national income of 5 times would be more likely to result when the capitalist consumption was equal to 2% of capital rather than to 3%, because of the implication of correspondingly greater saving by the capitalists. By the same token, a rate of consumption of 3% would be more likely to be accompanied by a ratio of accumulated capital to national income of 3 times rather than 5 times. In both cases, the capitalist consumption comes out to be on the order of 10% of national income. Now, these facts about the capitalist's special benefit from the institution of private property have an important bearing on the appraisal of demands for the redistribution of wealth and income, and for socialism, insofar as it is advocated as a method of redistribution. For after all is said and done, it is something on the order of a mere 10% of the national income, or less, that turns out to be the grand prize for which the redistributors and socialists are clamoring. Yes, this is the grand prize by means of which they expect to abolish all poverty, cure disease, and achieve utopia, and for which they are ready to overturn existing society, seize private property, and shed rivers of blood, all in magnificent obliviousness to the fact that capitalism itself gratuitously provides such wealth over and over again every 3 to 5 years, through a 2 or 3% annual rate of improvement in the productivity of labor and economic progress. These points need to be emphasized in order to understand the actual nature of the demands for redistribution and socialism. What I am saying is that even if the redistributors and socialists could succeed in appropriating the capitalist wealth without causing the destruction of that wealth or of its productivity, the utmost that they could physically achieve for the benefit of the average person that he does not already have is his share of the 10% or so of the national income that the capitalists presently consume. And this, of course, would be a one-time-only, non-repeatable benefit. Obviously, even if it could be obtained, such a benefit would not be worth fighting a revolution for, or even waging election campaigns for. But the fact is, of course, that no such benefit can be obtained. The attempt to seize it can only inflict injury on those intended to benefit from the seizure. It must deprive them both of all the future gains they would have had from the continued operation of capitalism and of all the gains they have already obtained from it up to that moment. For the capitalists cannot be forcibly prevented from consuming without losing interest in the management of their wealth and in its accumulation in the first place. Their wealth is valuable to them only insofar as it serves as a source of actual or potential consumption for them or their heirs. In degree that their ability to consume is forcibly restricted, the value to them of their wealth is destroyed. For example, a forced limitation of a capitalist's consumption to some fixed amount, such as $50,000 per year, would make all that portion of his wealth valueless to him that was beyond what was required to provide such an income and consumption. If, for example, he had $5 million of capital and the rate of return on capital were 5%, he would lose interest in the management of $4 million of his capital, since it would no longer be able to contribute anything to his life and well-being, and he would have no motive to accumulate such capital in the first place. If his consumption in his capacity as a capitalist were totally prohibited, then he would have no motive to maintain his capital at all, and no motive to accumulate any capital whatever in the first place. The socialization of the means of production would follow as a logical step in response to the destruction of the capitalist's incentives to accumulate and manage capital. And that, of course, for the reasons already shown, would also mean the collapse of production. Similar reasoning applies to proposals to limit the after-tax income of capitalists to some fixed amount, such as it was advocated by the late Eleanor Roosevelt and the late Walter Reuther, the Union leader. The enactment of such a proposal would first be accompanied by a decumulation of capital, to the extent that the capitalists considered their existing wealth sufficient to enable them to consume in excess of their statutorily limited income. For example, a limitation of income to $50,000 a year would not stop capitalists from consuming in excess of $50,000 a year, so long as they judge their capitals to be sufficient to provide such consumption. Such a limitation of income would obviously have to be followed by a limitation of consumption, and then by the government's taking over the management of capital as well, for the reasons just explained. The destructiveness of redistribution is evident in the very size of what the redistributors expect to accomplish and believe to be available as the means of accomplishing it. As they describe matters, what is available for raising the standard of living of the masses is not the mere 10% or so of the national income that the capitalists presently consume, but the whole of the capitalists' existing wealth. The propaganda of the redistributors and socialists depicts the capitalists as rich fat men whose larders are overflowing while the plates of the poor are empty. It demands that the capitalists' wealth be shared for purposes of mass consumption. Since in reality the wealth of the capitalists is in the form of factories and other capital goods, this is a blatant demand for capital decumulation. The poor are to be benefited by consuming the capital that underlies the productivity of labor and the payment of wages, and without which production must plunge. Thus, practically on its face, redistributionism is a policy of destruction. The destructiveness of redistributionism is further confirmed if we consider the specific means which the redistributors advocate for implementing their program, namely, government ownership of business enterprises and the progressive taxation of incomes and inheritances, and in non-division of labor societies, land reform. At this point, we will consider only government ownership of business enterprises. The government's ownership of a business supposedly makes every citizen an equal owner of that business, and in this way supposedly benefits him. Thus, every American is supposed to be a 1/220,000,000th owner of the U.S. Postal Service, Amtrak, the national parks, and so on. Yet one need hardly do more than name such examples in order to understand the destructiveness of government ownership. The citizen's share in government enterprises does him no good whatever. The fact that the enterprise is government-owned merely means that it is operated without benefit of profit and loss incentives and the freedom of competition. The result is almost always gross inefficiency, high costs, poor service, low quality of products, and often, despite subsidies to cover their losses, high prices. The average American is far better and more economically served by the privately owned telephone companies and airlines than he is by the U.S. Postal Service, Amtrak, and all the various municipally owned subway and bus lines. He is much better off dealing with them, even if he does not own a single share of their stock, than in dealing with the government enterprises that are supposed to be his. In fact, in one major case, the government's ownership of enormous areas of the western states and of Alaska, the effect of government ownership is to deprive the citizen of all possible economic benefit from the existence of the property. For the property is set aside as wildlife preserves and wilderness areas, and its economic development is either strictly prohibited or made extremely difficult and severely limited. The adverse consequences of government ownership are, of course, enormously compounded when it goes beyond the case of isolated industries to embrace the entire economic system. Then, in addition to the problems created directly by the lack of profit and loss incentives and the freedom of competition, there are the problems created by the destruction of the price system. The destruction of the price system means the destruction of the basis for economic calculation and for the coordination and integration of the economic plans of individuals. This means the destruction of rational economic planning as such and the consequent disintegration of the economic system into chaos. Putting aside for the moment the consequences of a socialized economic system as opposed to isolated socialized industries, it is worth noting that government ownership does not provide the alleged citizen owners with any of the special benefits of ownership that exist under private property. It is worth noting that government ownership does not provide the alleged citizen owners with any of the special benefits of ownership that exist under private property. Government ownership does not give the alleged citizen owner the psychological security that the possession of capital gives to a capitalist. For unlike the capitalist, he cannot sell his share in a government enterprise, nor does he receive dividends on it. In no sense does his alleged ownership provide him with any actual or potential means for consuming, and thus for enriching his life. Thus, in no way does it provide him with the distinctive benefits of ownership. The destruction of the special gains of ownership also arises in a further way, one that is applicable even in the context of a non-division of labor society. As soon as it is realized that redistributionism is to be a system, people stop accumulating or maintaining their wealth. There is thus very little for the recipients of later redistributions to receive. and what they do receive can give them no pleasure, insofar as they know that they themselves will in turn suffer expropriation. In the case of government ownership of industry, the citizen's share not only brings him none of the special gains of ownership, but, on the contrary, is almost always a liability to him, in that government enterprises almost inevitably incur deficits, which he, the average citizen, must make good through his taxes. Government-owned enterprises incur deficits precisely because it is the taxpayers who must make them good, under coercion. The administrators of the enterprises do not suffer any losses out of their own pockets, nor are they appointed or removable by those who do suffer the losses, the taxpayers. At best, they are appointed and removable by elected officials. But when it becomes one of the powers of government to own and operate business enterprises, these officials owe their election and their prospects for re-election to promises to favor some groups at the expense of other groups, namely large and vocal groups at the expense of small and quiet groups. The individual taxpayer is smaller and quieter than any group, and so he ends up the principal victim of pressure group warfare. The politicians and the bureaucrats they appoint are free to use the government enterprises to provide costly vote-buying services and to have them operate with inefficient methods of production that also buy votes by providing employment for pressure group members. And he, the taxpayer, must keep still and simply cover the deficits. Thus, the average citizen is a loser in his dealings with government enterprises, not only in his capacity as a consumer, but also in his capacity as an owner, the very capacity in which he was above all supposed to benefit. He is a loser both ways. And of course, the magnitude of his loss grows exponentially as the economic system approaches full socialization. The leading exceptions to the principle that the citizen loses even in his capacity as an owner of government enterprises is when such an enterprise has the good fortune to own and operate low-cost mineral deposits and at the same time enjoys substantial monopoly privileges in selling outside the country. This is the position of the nationalized oil industries of Kuwait, the Arab Emirates, Libya, and Saudi Arabia. These industries were established and developed by private oil companies, which continue to play a major role in their operation. Their success is principally the result of the fact that the United States government has granted them extensive monopoly privileges in the world market by severely hampering the activities of their major competitors, the American producers of oil and other forms of energy. The U.S. government has severely restricted the domestic production of oil, natural gas, coal, and atomic power through price controls and/or so-called environmental regulations. It has further restricted the supply of oil through the repeal of the depletion allowance, the imposition of the so-called windfall profits tax, and threats to break up the major oil companies and even to nationalize them. It has artificially increased the demand for oil through various environmental regulations. In the absence of these measures, the price of oil would not have risen any more than most other prices, and the inefficiencies of government ownership would have prevented the Arab countries from earning any great profits despite the high quality of their oil reserves. Further progress in the production of energy in a free United States would have inflicted losses on such inefficiently run outfits. As matters stand, the free telephones, free medical care, and so on that the citizens of Kuwait, say, are able to enjoy thanks to the dividends their government pays from its oil profits and the lesser benefits that the citizens of other thinly populated Arab countries obtain, all this is paid for by the impoverishment of everyone else in the world who must pay the artificially enhanced price of oil. To summarize our discussion in connection with the capitalist special benefit from ownership of the means of production, what we have seen is, first of all, that insofar as it takes the form of an enhanced consumption, it is quite small in relation to the size of the overall national income, and thus that nothing of significance could be gained by the average person from its seizure, even if it were possible to seize it. And then we have seen that the attempt to seize it must backfire in a radical decline in production and the overall volume of goods available, because the capitalists' incentive to accumulate and maintain their capitals would be destroyed, and the ensuing socialization of the economic system would also cause collapse. We have seen that redistributionism is destructive practically on its face, in that it is a call for the mass consumption of the capitalist capital. And then we have seen that a favorite method of the redistributors, the socialization of business, must cause losses to the average person, both in his capacity as a buyer of the products of the socialized businesses and in his capacity as an alleged owner of those businesses, and that not even the benefit of the psychological security provided by the ownership of capital can be transferred to him, since unlike the capitalist, he cannot sell his shares in his alleged property. Tomorrow, we will consider some special forms of the institution of private property, namely inheritance and the private ownership of land and natural resources. Both of these institutions have come in for special attack. They are denounced even by people who, in other respects, consider themselves supporters of private property. Our discussion will include an analysis of the effects of inheritance taxes and of progressive and corporate income taxes, whose effects are very similar. We will also consider the claim of the so-called conservationists that private ownership of land results in deforestation, the extermination of species, and in the too rapid depletion of mineral deposits. Thank you.